Hi, this is Dr. Ronald Hoffman. As we age, forestalling and even reversing bone loss becomes more and more important. That's why I've created the Intelligent Medicine Bone Health Protocol, my personal supplement recommendations to ensure your skeletal health. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com. In addition to the Bone Health Protocol, you'll find easy-to-follow links from my Supplement Starter Kit, Heart Health Protocol, and much more. These new protocols are an easy way for you to get the exact combination of targeted supplements you need to help you follow the intelligent medicine lifestyle, and for a limited time, you'll get free shipping on all of your store orders. For more details, just go to drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we're talking about chronic fatigue syndrome with an expert. She's Dr. Sarah Myhill. She's based in the UK, and she's author of a book, popular book called Sustainable Medicine, Whistleblowing on 21st Century Medical Practice, wherein you'll find her protocols and her approaches for dealing with a variety of health conditions. But her main focus is dealing with chronic fatigue syndrome. And in part one, we outlined her basic philosophy about chronic fatigue syndrome, that it is an energetic disease. It has to do with the mitochondria. So how do you repair the mitochondria and boost their function?
Well, the first step, even before looking at mitochondrial function, is to look at the fuel in the tank. And I've come to the view that the paleo ketogenic diet, paleo because it avoids modern foods like grains, dairy and yeast, ketogenic because the body needs to be fueled with fat and fiber, the paleo ketogenic diet is non-negotiable. I have to have patients doing that really well before it's worth spending energy, time, resources and money on other tests or looking in other directions. Mm-hmm. So the paleo ketogenic diet is so important. And as I say, I talk so much about this. And in fact, I produced another book called the PK Cookbook, which details how people can go about doing a paleo ketogenic diet. So that's the starting point. But with respect to mitochondria, essentially mitochondria can go slow for several reasons, but the two big reasons are either they are lacking the raw materials they need to work, or they are being blocked by something, they're being poisoned by something. So there, in my experience, there are five common rate limiting steps that mean the mitochondria won't go as well as they should. So even if you do not have access to the tests, you can take the package of supplement, which includes coenzyme Q10, 100 milligrams a day, vitamin B3, maybe 1500 milligrams as a slow release, acetyl-L-carnitine, maybe 1 to 2 grams daily, magnesium, 200 or 300 milligrams daily, and D-ribose, which is the raw material from which ATP is made. Mm-hmm. So with those five...
How much D-ribose? Because it's something where you can't just take like a 500 milligram or 100 milligram, 1,000 milligram pill. It's more like teaspoon-like doses, right?
Yes, yeah. A teaspoon is about 5 grams, and I like people to have 5 to 15 grams a day. Mm-hmm. But it is a sugar, and it has to be part of your carbohydrate count when you do the paleo-ketogenic diet. Mm-hmm. But again, it's a proven benefit. We know that works reliably well because it is, as I say, it's the raw material from which ATP, the energy molecule, is made. So those are the five nutritional supplements I particularly concentrate on. In addition, as part of the paleo-ketogenic diet, I like people to have a good multivitamin and a good multimineral and some essential fatty acids and some vitamin C. So that's what I call a basic package of supplements that we should all be doing because Western diets are chronically deficient in those things.
Can I run a couple of others by you? We're hearing some buzz about a form of coenzyme Q10 called MitoQ. With some recent exciting papers, limited, however, and perhaps, we should make sure that those aren't proprietary, that they aren't, sponsored by the manufacturers of MitoQ, that show that it actually specifically targets that's why it's called MitoQ, that it targets the mitochondria.
Well, You know, I don't see the logic of that, because I can't see how it cannot target mitochondria, because mitochondria are common to all living cells. I have to stick by the science that I know, and I measure CoQ10 levels routinely. Mm-hmm. They come up reliably well with the supplements, so much so that these days I don't waste my patients' money on re-measuring levels, because I know they will be good.
Okay.
And of course, to get coenzyme Q10 and these minerals into the body, one has to think about gut function. And a very common problem associated with Western diets is what I call the upper fermenting gut. If you have a diet which is high in carbohydrates, then there is potential for those carbohydrates to get fermented in the stomach. And that is a metabolic disaster. Mm-hmm. Why? Because any supplements you take go to feed those microbes in the upper gut. Those microbes ferment carbohydrates to produce toxins such mm-hmm. as alcohol, D-lactate, hydrogen sulfide,
aldehydes, and so on, yeah.
Aldehydes, all of which, you know, overwhelm the liver's defenses and poison the body. And thirdly, you get a buildup of abnormal, unfriendly bacteria and yeast in the upper gut, which have the potential to get from the gut into the bloodstream. Now, this is called bacterial translocation. And when I was at medical school, I was taught that this doesn't happen, but of course we now know it absolutely does. And these bacteria get into the bloodstream. They don't cause a septicemia or an acute flu-like symptoms, but they can drive allergic reactions at distal sites. So, for example, we now know that an awful lot of arthritis is driven by mm-hmm. bacteria from the upper yeah. fermenting gut. The classic example is ankylosing spondylitis, which is driven by Klebsiella. Mm-hmm. But you know, the bottom line is we shouldn't have those bacteria there at all. So, you know, don't feed them with sugars and carbohydrates, because that's what they love to ferment. So getting on the paleoketogenic diet greatly improves gut function. It greatly enhances the absorption of these micronutrients that you're taking. And you want to take these micronutrients to feed you, not to feed the wretched upper fermenting microbes, upper gut fermenting microbes. So, as I say, CoQ10 levels in the blood come up reliably well with bog standard ubiquinol. Ditto carnitine levels come up in the bloodstream reliably well with bog standard carnitine. Ditto niacinamide, which is cheap. Mm-hmm. And my view is people need at least 500, maybe 1500 milligrams a day. It's extremely safe. I've never seen any toxicity or problems with those supplements.
On, so on this the theory is a very that it's a B3 or you know, niacinamide is also called nicotinamide. It's a building block for NAD, the yes. energy compound that's ubiquitous within the cells.
Correct. You know, it's just like ubiquinol is called that because it is ubiquitously present. So is NAD, niacinamide. Mm-hmm. And I use it in that form. If you use niacin, you can get a terrible flush sure. with that, which yeah. is not desirable. But niacinamide is very well tolerated generally.
And stateside, something called nicotinamide riboside is getting some traction. Is that available over there in the UK, or do you have any experience with it?
I don't know, and I don't have any experience with it, and I don't need any experience with it. Why? Because I know the bog standard cheapo niacinamide works perfectly well. Mm-hmm. It brings blood levels up reliably well. It's affordable and it's remarkably free from side effects and well tolerated.
Okay. So your basic protocol, I mean, you mentioned the Stone Age diet or the PK diet, but there are other elements to the basic restoration protocol.
Yes.
As you mentioned, supplements, a standard package of supplements that you just
yes.
reviewed. But another factor that is you know, very, very problematic in patients with CFS is sleep. And it's not yes. as if they're not, you know, hanging out and debilitated and bedbound.
Yeah.
They just don't sleep well. So how do we
Correct.
Address that?
Okay. Well, there are two. I mean, believe you me, I don't know all the answers to sleep, but I do know some of them. Now, the commonest cause of disturbed sleep is adrenaline. Now, if people are fueling their body with carbohydrates and sugars, what that means is that a video of their blood sugar would look like the Rocky Mountains. It would be up every time they have some carbohydrate. As the blood sugar comes up, there's an outpouring of insulin, and therefore blood sugar comes rocketing down. The brain then panics. It thinks it's going to run out of fuel, and it pours out the panic hormone, which is adrenaline. And guess what? Adrenaline will disturb sleep better than anything else. So if people tell me, yes, they can get off to sleep, but then they're waking every 2 or 3 hours, and some people say to me, oh, and do you know what? If I go and have a cup of tea and a biscuit, I can get off to sleep again. That makes the diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So metabolic syndrome, i.e. fueling the body with sugars and carbohydrates, interferes with sleep. And the starting point, again, is the paleo-ketogenic diet. But, of course, when we sleep and the timing of that is determined by hormones. And we start off with light. And what light does is it lands on the skin and it stops the body making melatonin. As light fades and it goes dark, that stimulates the pineal gland in the brain to make melatonin. And that kicks off a cascade of hormones throughout the night. So melatonin levels increase. That produces the sleep pressure, and we drop off to sleep. We then have involvement of thyroid hormones and adrenal hormones. Now, TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone, that spikes at about midnight. Levels of T4 come up during the early hours and spike at about 4 a.m. That is converted to the active hormone T3, and that spikes at 5 a.m. That kicks the adrenals into life, and there's an outpouring of adrenal hormones at 6 or 7, and that wakes us up. So it's the varying levels of melatonin, thyroid hormones, adrenal hormones, and probably other hormones that I don't know about throughout the night that gives us the quality sleep at the right moment in the 24 hours. So I then discuss with my patients, yes, ketogenic diet, so they don't get the adrenaline spike, maybe taking a melatonin supplement, and then, dare I say it, balancing up the thyroid and the adrenal glands, because not only are they essential part of energy delivery mechanisms, they're also an essential part of our circadian rhythm.
Yeah, it, paradoxically, what I've discovered, perhaps you have as well, is that patients who are hypothyroid, and even if they have normal thyroid tests, sometimes they're low normal and they have all the symptoms of hypothyroidism, we give them thyroid, which we think of as a stimulant, an energizer, but it actually makes them sleep deeper. Why might that be?
Well, because thyroid hormones are an essential part of when we sleep and the quality of sleep that we get. So that doesn't surprise me in the slightest. Again, one of the things that makes me very cross with the conventional approach is that the doctors don't listen to the patients in diagnosing hypothyroidism. They just look at the blood test.
They don't even look at the patients anymore. They're just looking at their EMR screens and eye contact anymore.
I know. It's absolutely shameful. But it's so important to realize that, yes, the blood tests are a guide, but they are never a definitive answer. And, for example, the normal range for T4 is 12 to 22 picomoles per liter. If a result came back at 12.1, a conventional doctor would tell that patient, you're fine, there's nothing wrong with the thyroid. Mm. But they might feel much better running at 20 or even 22. In fact, a book produced by Professor Sir Anthony Toff, the BMA Guide to Treating Hypothyroidism, states that some patients don't feel well until their T4 is running at 30. Mm-hmm. And so there are other issues with the thyroid because, of course, T4 is relatively inactive. It's converting the body to T3, which is what does the business.
Yep.
And if you have poor conversion of T4 to T3, then guess what? You're going to be fatigued.
Which happens when you're ill. I mean, there's such a thing as poor conversion, which we know of as a medical phenomenon in sick patients. And these are the sickest of the patients.
Indeed. And then, again, we have another phenomenon which is called thyroid hormone receptor resistance, which means even if you've got good levels of T4 and even if you've got good levels of T3, it's not impacting on the receptors. And this is akin to the epidemics of type 2 diabetes we're seeing at the moment, where people having high blood sugars, they've got lots of insulin. So it's not they're lacking insulin, but they have insulin resistance. Mm-hmm. And guess what? The very things that cause insulin resistance, which is toxins in the environment, heavy metals, pesticides, also cause thyroid hormone receptor resistance. So often these patients have a double whammy. They have metabolic syndrome and they're pre-diabetic because they're running their bodies on sugars and carbohydrates. And that also causes thyroid hormone receptor resistance. So goodness me, if you've got no fuel in the tank and no accelerator pedal, no wonder you're as flat as a pancake.
Exactly. And treating a thyroid is an art, but it doesn't even hold a candle to the complexity of treating the adrenals. Some patients exhibit too much cortisol. They're subject to continual stress, and other patients have adrenal burnout, we could call it that, where they're making inadequate adrenal hormones. So how can we support the proper functioning of the adrenals?
Well, if the tests, and I tend to use saliva tests for an adrenal stress profile, I find that a very helpful test. Genova do that test, and it's a useful test. If you find the cortisol level is very high, of course, cortisol follows adrenaline. So we can infer from that that the adrenaline levels are high, i.e. that person is stressed. So we have to address the causes of that stress. Now, dare I say it, the commonest cause of that stress is metabolic syndrome, i.e. running the body on sugars and carbohydrates. And very often that's all one has to do to bring levels of cortisol down.
It's not necessarily a bad boss or a problematic spouse. It's actually the body is generating stress from within that causes cortisol to rise in response to these metabolic stressors.
That is correct. And that is by far and away, in my view, the commonest cause of chronically raised high cortisol levels.
So diet can be a fix for that. Are there certain adaptogens which you favor the use of?
No, again, as I get older and perhaps wiser, although I have to say my daughters doubt that very much, as I get older, my medicine gets more simple. Mm-hmm. And what I find is that the very basic things done really well gets you an awful long way there. Mm-hmm. And because, dare I say it, because the diet is so difficult, people look for other ways to get well. You know, they find the diet inconvenient. It doesn't live up to their expectations. It's not very sociable. So they think, oh, won't worry about that. But let's look at all this other stuff. But once you get the diet right, everything else falls into place. It's much easier to treat the thyroid because you're not running into problems with thyroid hormone receptor resistance necessarily. The diet invariably reduces the fermenting gut, and that reduces the toxic load. And again, as you iron out adrenaline levels, you reduce the stress on the adrenals and give them half a chance to recover. So if the adrenal stress profile shows high levels of cortisol, then I'm simply looking for the cause of that stress and deal with that in whatever way. If the adrenal gland is showing low levels of cortisol or low levels of DHEA, then increasingly these days I use glandulars. Yeah. I use glandulars because, A, we know they're effective. They have a very good track record. And, B, patients can access them themselves. They don't have to go to the doctor. They don't need a prescription. They can access glandulars directly.
And of course, another aspect of dealing with stress, and this is a part of your basic protocol, is, and you refer to it as work-rest balance, because, you know, you really have to have a context for healing. I find that some of my patients with chronic fatigue syndrome are in such challenging circumstances that they're really not, no matter what they do, whether they're on the most impeccable diet or taking the best supplements, the context is not right for healing.
Yeah. I agree. That is very, very difficult. And, it's back to, as I call it, the Mr. McCorvin equation and, you know, income and outgoings. And, of course, people often get into chronic fatigue syndrome, or ME because they never allow their body to rest. They're constantly pushing. They're constantly striving. In fact, I could stop a very good Olympic team from the athletes that I see who have overtrained, split themselves into a chronic fatigue syndrome.
We've seen that, yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Another aspect of this is detoxification, because we know, one of the reasons that the mitochondria go awry, in addition to diet, in addition to stress, in addition to poor glandular function, is toxins. Toxins directly attack the membranes of the mitochondria, disrupt the chemical reactions within the mitochondria. So how do you approach that with your patients?
Well, I'm very lucky because I have Acumen Laboratory who can do translocator protein function tests and discern what these toxins are. But you can get very similar tests of toxicity at other laboratories. Genova Laboratory, for example, they do a core profile which looks at pesticides, volatile organic compounds, and toxic metals. But broadly, I mean, the fact of the matter is we are all poisoned because we live in such a toxic world. We all carry a toxic load. And arguably, we should all be doing detox mm-hmm. regimes to improve our presence.
Presumptively. In other words, without fancy or elaborate metric to tell us how toxic we are, it's probably a fair assumption that we should undergo detoxification.
Correct. Correct. And of course, dare I say it, that starts with, you know, paleoketogenic diet and a good package of nutritional supplements. But I've seen a great many farmers with organophosphate poisoning. I've seen aerotoxic pilots who've been poisoned by engine exhaust fumes, which again include organophosphates. I've seen 9/11 firemen who are poisoned by the toxic burning plastics. So toxic causes of ME are very common. And of course, the Gulf War veterans were poisoned. Mm-hmm. And the way to get rid of these toxins is by some sort of heating regime. Now, the point here is if you warm the body up, then these volatile organic compounds, these pesticides, they literally start to evaporate from the subcutaneous fat onto the lipid layer on the surface of the skin, and they can then be washed off. So it doesn't matter what the heating regime is. Now, if you've got an athlete who can run, then obviously exercise followed by a shower would be a very good way of getting rid of these toxic chemicals. Any saunering, Turkish baths, fire infrared saunering, sunbathing, hot baths with Epsom salts, all of these interventions do exactly the same thing. They mobilize the chemicals from the subcutaneous fat onto the surface of the skin from whence they can be washed off. So it's a case of finding the technique that suits you. If you love having a sauna once a week, be fantastic. If you've got the energy to go and exercise and have a run, perfect. If the sun's shining, go and sunbathe. So there are, you know, many different ways to skin a cat, as we call it in this country. but that won't do for the toxic metals.
Yes.
Toxic metals, yeah, they get stuck in the body. In particular, they get stuck in the heart, the brain, the bone marrow, and the kidneys. And therefore, the blood tests, the hair tests, the urine tests for toxic metals are not reliable because they're not in those departments. And guess what? Nobody's going to do a brain biopsy on me or a heart biopsy on me to see that. So to be able to diagnose a toxic metal problem, we have to use a chelating agent. And the one that I use, again, is available online. It's called DNSA or Captoma. Mm-hmm. And the key here is you want to do a urine test to measure toxic elements. So empty the bladder, take DMSA at the rate of 15 milligrams per kilogram of body weight, collect your urine for the next 6 hours, and send a sample of that off to either BioLab or Genova Laboratories or Doctor's Data or whatever. They all do this test. Mm-hmm. And if you have a toxic metal problem, the DMSA will grab that toxic metal, whether it's mercury or lead or arsenic or aluminium, and pull it out through the urine, and you will see elevated levels.
Indeed.
It will also pull out the friendly minerals like zinc and copper and selenium. So you may expect to see high levels of those. That's not poisoning with those things. That's mm-hmm. simply because that's what DMSA does. So you need to interpret the results in the light of that. But with those two tests and those detox techniques and the diet, you can deal with a huge amount of modern toxic stress.
Do you see a role for glutathione support in patients who need to detox?
Absolutely. Glutathione is a very, very helpful detox agent. Again, I've come to the view that because we live in such a toxic world, we should probably all be taking glutathione all the time. Not a huge dose, 250 milligrams a day would do. Because don't wait until that toxin has triggered some sort of nasty pathology. My view is just take it as a prophylactic, as an insurance policy, if you like.
Indeed. Well, okay, so lots of resources can be found, of course, in your book, Sustainable Medicine. And not just on chronic fatigue syndrome, you actually deliver protocols for a variety of common ailments. But when it comes to healing from chronic fatigue syndrome, where can patients look to? There's naturalhealthworldwide.com. Tell us what people will find there.
Well, they will there find a practitioner who is experienced in treating patients with chronic fatigue syndrome or ME. Now, they might be a doctor with qualified doctor like myself. They might be somebody with a health qualification such as herbalism or naturopathic medicine, or they may be an experienced patient, i.e. someone who has been there, done that, got well, and knows the ins and outs of diet and nutritional supplements who can help. And many of the therapists on that site are giving their time without cost, just because they want to give back to the ME community a little bit that they've taken. So it's a very friendly site. It's very easy to use. It's very popular. And there's a feedback system on that. So if you consult with the practitioner, you can then say, yes, that was a health helpful consultation, or it's good value, or the you've seen benefits, or whatever. So it's a little bit like Amazon. You know, you can choose your product and give feedback, and that enhances that practitioner's reputation so that they can help you some more.
And it's an international directory.
It is, yes. Anybody, if you've got access to the internet, anybody can get onto that and choose a therapist and get in contact with them, and at whatever level they wish to be treated.
I know that you're all about empowering patients to undertake their own self-healing protocol wherever they might be, but you mentioned earlier, you alluded to the fact that you treat Gulf War veterans, 9/11 survivors, Ground Zero rescue personnel who experienced toxicity. Does that mean that you see patients internationally? They come to England for a workup?
Well, I do, but because I'm so overwhelmed with patients at the moment, I'm actually saying no to new patients. But what I do as part of the Natural Health Worldwide website is if a practitioner gets stuck with a patient and doesn't know where to go, then they can ask me. They can just give me a brief question, or I can do a full management plan for that patient and then hand them back to the practitioner. And the practitioners find that very useful, because if they do get stuck, there's somewhere they can go. And obviously I'm training other doctors to offer that same service, so that because I'm rapidly getting overwhelmed with questions from the NHW practitioners. But that's been helpful to patients and helpful to those practitioners. And of course they learn the sort of techniques that I'm doing, and that helps to spread the word generally.
Okay, well, be careful what you wish for, because there are health professionals who listen to this, and I myself might be asking you for a lifeline from time to time with challenging patients, because we
You're
certainly do
welcome.
See them. Thank you. So, you know, once again, the book Sustainable Medicine, that's your popular book. And for health professionals, it's the authoritative text, Diagnosis and Treatment of CFS and Myalgic Encephalitis. And on your website, there are actually really some fascinating studies that involve a little bit of a deep dive into medical research. But for our health professionals and our enlightened listeners, you might go there. Can you give the destination for your website?
No, that's just drmyhill.co.uk.
Okay.
If you just Google Dr. Myhill, it comes up. I try to get all my information is out there on the website, freely available to anybody who wants to use it and take advantage of it.
Well, great. Yeah, you're most generous in sharing your research and your information, and I congratulate you on being a pioneer in what is clearly a very, very challenging area of medicine, but perhaps that's why practitioners of excellence like you are needed to address this epidemic, because literally there are tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of patients who are sidelined with this condition, and they're not being treated appropriately.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And in fact, this is a sort of medical abuse, because these are sick patients who are being refused proper biomedical treatment through sheer ignorance. And I'm calling on our government for a public inquiry into this, as to why these patients are being so badly treated and so ignored and so maligned. It is absolutely wrong.
Well, thank you for the activism that you bring to the fore, because I think that's also an element of this, is convincing the powers that be. And you do have a monolithic National Health Service out yes. there in England, and it's tough battling them to get them to change their approach, so that people who not necessarily are of wealthy means can access treatments that are of value.
Yes, yes, that is correct. I mean, the problem with doctors, as I'm sure you're well aware, is that doctors are not educated properly these days. They're educated by the drug companies. And of course, if you're a big pharmaceutical firm, then you want to sell drugs. And the best way to sell drugs is to get the doctor to prescribe them in symptom suppressing ways. So, and of course, we have symptoms for very good reasons. We have symptoms to alert us to the fact that there's a problem there. So we have pain in the knee, which is a symptom that there's degeneration in the knee or inflammation in the knee. To suppress that symptom with a painkiller or an anti-inflammatory makes that underlying pathology progress even faster, because a knee that should be rested and looked after and manipulated and fed is no longer painful, so the patient goes on using it as normal. And guess what? It breaks down faster.
Well, I doubt if that magic bullet approach is going to be successful in dealing with chronic fatigue syndrome, which is such a complex disorder. Thank you very much for joining us, and congratulations on the accolades that have been given to you for being a pioneer in this field.
My pleasure. It's been a pleasure talking to you. You're asking all the right questions, and that is half the battle.
Indeed. Thank you so much. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and our guest, Dr. Sarah Myhill. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.